yes. In the South, perhaps one of the very few absolutely outstanding presses in the nation. And when they received the manuscript, they were absolutely thrilled by the both by the research and the content, but also by the writing. And with that in mind, why Newcomb Hall Bookstore, which is very anxious that scholars at the University of Virginia become better known to people, have brought some copies if any of you should want to probe this subject more fully. And you could see them at the door as you leave. This was my idea, not Valerie's. background of Dr. Sutter is very interesting. Bob has stepped out, but Bob's here. She and Bob Sutter have a wonderful family of University of Virginia graduates and others, and she continued her career throughout her family years, but then as her daughter Karen enrolled in the University of Virginia, she pressed forward to complete her doctoral degree, and turned out to be one of the most outstanding performances in the PhD field that we have had here. She was associated with several of us at the Miller Center. Her dissertation was entitled The Indochinese Refugees and the National Interests. She holds other degrees in addition to her doctorate, a master's in education from the Curry School of Education, a bachelor's of science of education from the State University of New York at the college at Cortland. She is currently the assistant director of the Social Foundations of Education program in Northern Virginia of the University of Virginia, and also assistant professor of education. She's received many awards, including the Institute for the Study of Politics Award, the Governor's Fellowship, the New York State Region Scholarship, and a Fulbright Hayes Seminars Award in connection with this project. She's traveled and done research in Southeast Asia, in the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, Europe, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. She's taught comparative education, Soviet education, the history of American education, comparative education generally, and she's made numerous presentations at scholarly and professional society meetings. So it's a great pleasure. Frank Elliott is always complaining that we don't do enough to do two things, bring back our own to these meetings and also get the mean age of presenters down, and I think we've accomplished both again today. So we're delighted Valerie is with us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thompson, and thank you all for coming. It's certainly an honor to be invited here to the Miller Center. My memories of this room go back to seminars around this table, actually, when guest speakers would come and I would be in Dr. Thompson's classes, and we would be invited here to the Miller Center for a special lecture. And so it is indeed nice to be back, and certainly interesting to be the speaker today. I think the first order of business is really to express sincere gratitude to Dr. Thompson for all that he has provided for me in terms of opportunity. As he pointed out in describing my background, I'm what you might call a late bloomer. I came back to graduate school long after my children were, in a sense, launched in their own school careers. And so coming back sort of late in life, when I finally had figured out what I wanted to be, I was really taken with the notion that perhaps the sign of a democratic society is the opportunities that are available for people to come back into the educational system and move ahead in that regard. And that certainly was the case for me at the University of Virginia in the early 1980s. And so Dr. Thompson played a particularly important role in all that I did, from the time that I began taking classes here to the time when he suggested to me that I might even have a dissertation topic at hand, and certainly even through to the completion of the manuscript and turning it into a book for Louisiana State University Press. There's another individual here that I would like to publicly acknowledge in terms of my gratitude, and that is my husband, Bob Sutter. Without him, no effort like this is ever done alone, and in this case with young children at home, etc., it was especially important to have his cooperation, his help, his assistance, and also his professional expertise along the way. I'd like to explain a little bit about how I came to this issue and then launch into a sketching of the study itself, and then leave plenty of time at the end of the after about 40 minutes for your questions, and maybe we can have some dialogue on what I think is a very compelling issue. One of the things that happened at about the time I was re-entering university life were some demographic changes in Northern Virginia, where I live. And that most notably were the Vietnamese boat people that were coming to Northern Virginia, living in the Washington area. This began in 1979, but certainly by 1982, it was apparent in my own neighborhood, for example, that these people were here. They were here to stay, and there was an important story that was related to why they actually came to this country. I think the second most important reason why I was drawn to the Indo-Chinese refugee issue is that for Americans, for myself, coming of age during the Vietnam era, that experience in our history touched most of us, all of us, in ways perhaps that we don't even know. And I was taken with just the Peter Jennings show of last week. You may have seen it last Thursday night, Return to the Killing Fields, that 15 years after the fact, after we have actually withdrawn from Vietnam, this experience continues to affect our thinking and our point of view, et cetera. And so I know that within that context that I was very much drawn to the story. As I looked around and I knew that I wanted to do something about the Indo-Chinese refugees dilemma, I was never exactly sure where I was headed with this. I felt that when you go to graduate school at mid-age, you better have a story to tell. There's no time to sit around and sort of muse about what you might write about, and it was important for me to, in a sense, begin with the idea that I might write a book someday. And in many respects, what I was doing at that point was saying, I don't know where I'm going, but follow me. And some people actually did. The complex story of the Indo-Chinese refugees is really a play or an interplay between human rights and politics. And at first glance, I know when I began looking at it, I saw that these two areas were diametrically opposed, and I really needed to have some kind of guideline or framework with which to approach this very complex, multifaceted issue. And so I turned to Dr. Thompson and essentially his theory of political realism, of which you are probably very much aware, and he has written many books. And I can remember the time when I first came to the university, and it was suggested to me that I try to contact Dr. Thompson, and I thought that was a marvelous idea. and was in the process of doing so. And I was on the lawn one day and chatting with another graduate student, and the graduate student said, "Well, do you know who this Dr. Thompson is?" And I said, "Well, I know a little bit about him, but maybe you can tell me more." And he said, "Well, instead of my telling you, I suggest you go right now to Alderman Library and look in the card catalog," which I did. And I must say that I was overwhelmed, because as I took out a little piece of paper to jot down Dr. Thompson's titles of the books he has written, I soon realized that I was talking about inches in the card catalog. This was before the computerized system. And so in many respects, I was certainly intimidated at first, but what happened was that it came to be a very fruitful experience for me in terms of understanding the refugee problem, because it was through Dr. Thompson that I came to have an understanding of political realism. He introduced me to people like Herbert Butterfield, Hans Morgenthau, Reinhold Niebuhr, George Kennan, and of course his own interpretations. And many of the things that I learned from these great thinkers I mention in the book in the beginning chapter, but in particular in understanding a complex humanitarian issue like the refugees, it was important to me to know that there is a strong relation between politics and morality and that they are not necessarily mutually exclusive. It was important for me to come to an understanding about the primacy of national interests. It was important for me to also come to know that when you study an issue, you need to come to understand it before you can be in a position of judging. And probably from Herbert Butterfield, one of the lines I remember from him is that you needed, the researcher needs to put oneself in the shoes of another. And so that was the way I went about looking at the refugee issue, trying to put myself in the shoes of not only the refugees, but the countries from where they came, the first asylum countries, etc. And finally, the important distinction here that Dr. Thompson helped me with was to distinguish between moralizing and the more important concept of moral reasoning. And all of this gave me the perspective that I think helped me to, in many cases, unravel this very complex issue. What I would like to do in the next several minutes is talk about three or four major points that I cover in the book. The first one would be the roots of the exodus. How is it that over 2 million people have made the very dramatic decision to leave their homelands? The second topic would be asylum. Where do these people go after they leave Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia? And how is it that they are treated once they arrive in asylum countries like Thailand and Hong Kong and Malaysia and the Philippines? And then thirdly, I would hope to mention a few things about the resettlement process. Dr. Thompson mentioned that we have large numbers of Indo-Chinese refugees now living in the United States, and I'm sure here in the Charlottesville area you are very familiar with their presence at the University of Virginia. Not only their presence, but their outstanding achievements here at the university, only 15 years after the exodus began. And then finally, when we get to some conclusions and some questions, to perhaps raise some of the humanitarian concerns that are inherent in the foregoing story. Dr. Thompson mentioned that over 2 million refugees have left the countries of Indochina, and that is certainly true. The other part to that is, in terms of an update, that just last year alone, 1989, over 100,000 refugees left the country of Vietnam. And so the point there is that this exodus has been going on for 15 years, and it shows absolutely no signs of lessening. In fact, last year was really a crisis point. Up until about 1987, we could say that the situation had been managed for several years. But beginning in 87 and certainly into 88, enormous numbers of people were leaving once again, especially from Vietnam. And I'd like to turn to each of the three Indochina countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, and just show you how perhaps each one is a little different and how they are similar in terms of the reasons why people feel that they are persecuted or they fear persecution, and that still today they leave that country. I might mention that I've just returned from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. I was there during the month of January, and so some of the things that I wrote about and researched are very more clear to me now than ever, having seen things firsthand. The first thing about Vietnam is, of course, the political repression. And when we were in Vietnam, it was interesting that I think the Vietnamese were running a little scared. They thought perhaps they were going to be the last socialist country in the world as things were unraveling, certainly in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. But in many cases, especially in the south of the country, after the country was unified in 1975, thousands of people were sent to re-education camps. And they were essentially punished for their association with the American war effort and really for being on the wrong side of that war. Coupled with that, of course, is the terrible economic situation in Vietnam. It is one of the poorest countries in the world. The per capita income is just over $100 a year. And so there's just evidence of extreme poverty throughout the country, especially in the north. And in many cases, we could say, I think rightfully so, and it was mentioned in the paper, and I think it was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that socialism has failed in Vietnam, certainly the Vietnamese brand of socialism. And so the political repression, the economic situation, have influenced very strongly people's decisions to flee that country. Another part of the exodus has been the ethnic Chinese population in Vietnam. Not so much today, but certainly in the early 80s, when the ethnic Chinese were considered by the Vietnamese government to be a fifth column. And it was at the time of growing tension and eventual animosity between China and Vietnam, and in many cases the ethnic Chinese in the country were caught in the middle and they fled, and many of the boat people were the ethnic Chinese. There are some signs of change in Vietnam today. There is the Vietnamese version of perestroika called Doi Moi. But interestingly, while it seems to bear the fruits of an economic liberalization, what is missing is any kind of a political liberalization. There is lip service to that, but there is no clear evidence that, in fact, they are liberalizing. And in many respects, it's very similar to what's gone on in China, where you have an economic modernization going on, but the political piece of that puzzle has not kept pace with the economic reforms, and it has spelled trouble. All of this, the situation inside of Vietnam leading to the exodus, is compounded actually by American foreign policy. You are probably aware that it has been U.S. policy since 1975, when we left Vietnam or Indochina, to, in a sense, isolate and some people would say punish Vietnam for winning the war. And so we do that in two ways. There has been a trade embargo in effect for 15 years, and I might add that it is very effective. It's my understanding, for example, that the Japanese would like very much to get in and develop Vietnam, but they watch the United States and follow the move of the United States in that regard. And secondly, we do not have any diplomatic relations with either Vietnam or Cambodia. So basically, we have a very poor country, a country where political repression has occurred and still occurs, a very underdeveloped country, and that really constitutes the roots of the exodus from there. Very quickly, in terms of Cambodia is intrinsically linked to the Vietnam situation. It is also a very poor country. But in terms of the refugees per se, the refugee issue in Cambodia is basically about a little over 300,000 refugees that are basically people were moving into the asylum countries and eventually out of them within a year or two and coming to the West. From the perspective of the asylum countries, where especially countries like Thailand and Hong Kong, it's important to note that while we could ostensibly look to these countries and see a clear violation of human rights as they are reluctant to take in these people, you may have remembered way back in 1979 where there were actually push-offs by Malaysia not allowing people that were coming from Vietnam to disembark in Malaysia, and many people died in the process. I will point out, too, that Malaysia has reinstituted that policy, and just last year alone, over 4,000 refugees were turned away from Malaysia, and at least seven people lost their lives. But to look at it from the perspective of these countries in terms of national interests, basically we're talking about developing countries, where an influx of refugees can be very destabilizing, not only economically but politically. There are also evidences of ethnic animosity, and I can remember being in Malaysia back in about 1984 and someone from our embassy explaining to me what perhaps the Malaysians were thinking, a Muslim country, were thinking when they saw hundreds and hundreds of Vietnamese people landing at their shores, and he said it all boiled down to here were these pork-eating people landing in Malaysia. I mean, it really, he brought it down to its core. And finally, what the ASEAN countries have always been concerned about, ASEAN and Hong Kong as asylum countries, is that in many respects, their liberal asylum policies are thought to create a magnet effect. So the nicer it is for a refugee in Thailand, the more refugees will actually come to Thailand. And so they were out to curb that. And certainly by 1987, the crisis that I spoke of alerted the world community of the need to once again address this ongoing problem. There was another Geneva conference last June, and again, still very problematic. We haven't worked out all the problems, and I think basically what the issue is, we haven't gone to the root causes of the issue. It's still in a management type of focus in terms of how we treat this issue. Very quickly, to make a couple of comments about resettlement, again, the United States takes the lead in this area. And I might point out, too, that it has been American foreign policy since the end of the Vietnam War to maintain a low profile in the region. Sometimes it's referred to as the Vietnam syndrome, and that's certainly part of that. But basically, that policy has been to follow the lead politically of the ASEAN countries, and also what it's a little bit out of favor today, but certainly over the years, was to play the China card and to perhaps look more to China in terms of a role in that region. But by so doing, by assuming a low profile, what the United States did do was assume a leadership role in the area of refugees. And this served two functions. One was that it served to highlight the human rights abuses in the Indochina countries. And two, by resettling large numbers of refugees, it meant that the United States could contribute to the stability of the non-communist countries in the region, the ASEAN countries. And of course, we shouldn't neglect the compelling moral reasons for why we became involved in the refugee issue. And this is still continuing, I might add. This is reflected, of course, in our Vietnam War experience and the responsibility we have to the people of that region, but it is particularly manifested in our concern about the Amerasians, the large contingent of the offspring of American servicemen and Vietnamese, re-education camp prisoners, and also family reunification, to bring together the family members of those that are still in Vietnam with those that are now resettled in the United States. But this resettlement policy, again, looking at some of the conflicts between human rights, foreign policy, and in this case, domestic policy, when we start talking about resettlement and perhaps bringing families to the state of Virginia, whatever, we start talking about things that are very close to home. And so the resettlement process has not been without its critics in the United States. One of the loudest criticism, I think, of the resettlement program has been... Of course, one of those issues, the emotional issue, is the MIAs, and that it has not been resolved. And there are many opinions about that, running from people that firmly believe that the Vietnamese actually hold the bodies of American servicemen, and, you know, in a very ghoulish way, you know, send them out once in a while when it's to their advantage, versus those that say, no, in any war of this nature, after so many years, you will never recover the remains of those people. So that seems to be a very emotional issue that plays on the minds of the American people, and that limits their willingness or to approach Vietnam.
Wilson, Newman.
Dr. Sutter, I'm enormously impressed by the subject that you have raised, but it seems to me that you are raising a larger subject than you have enunciated. I was particularly interested in your comment about the comparison of morality and national interest, and balancing that with the subject of realism from Ken Thompson and his recent book on Churchill's comparative weighting of these elements seems to me to bear on this subject. Enough of comment, now the question. It seems to me that your analysis of these friction points in anthropology or social or political matters, you have recited a great deal of evidence showing friction in society as a whole. But I'd like to see you take it to the step, one step further, and answer the question, and I don't mean this to be flippant, but so what? What we have, I'm thinking now of introducing the element of time. Philosophically, what is the goal in relation between peoples and nations? We know in our own country when gasoline gets short, people line up and we have a lot of fender bumpers. What's going to happen? We, in advocating many of these things, are we doing it for a Munich, a peace in our time, to make us feel better without contributing to the long term, ultimately? In other words, where does all this lead? Mm-hmm. There's no problem as to what the motivation is. And if I were
Okay. Now, I think you certainly have zeroed in on an important aspect, and I don't know that there is a single answer. I think in a question as complex as that, we can look to a variety of individuals that have talked about things like that. One of the persons that comes to mind is Edmund Kahn, who talked about morality in that in some ways we are we identify with people, say refugees, because we almost in a dramatic sense or a histrionic sense, we sense their vulnerability. I think that was particularly true with the media, for example, and when you see pictures of boat people being pushed away from a shore or whatever. And that's an immediate, emotional, poignant kind of a thing. But you're quite right. What happens when that's over, when we don't really grapple with the important moral reasoning aspects of all of that? You know, what is the long-term answer? I would think that specifically related to the refugee issue, I feel that, for example, this whole resettlement process in the United States where we've taken 1 million people, what are we going to do? Take everybody out of Vietnam eventually over the next 50 or 75 years until there is no one in that country? You know, if we don't think it through, and I think that in terms of of looking at it in a more complex way, what your question gets at perhaps is related to what I say in terms of looking at the root causes, why it is people leave, and addressing those root causes in the sense that if we addressed our own foreign policy interests, not so much in the short term but in the long term, it might even be in the American interest to have Vietnam move ahead economically and then hopefully even politically have changes there, because that in effect would curtail the refugee flow. There was a wonderful, and I can't remember his name, philosopher that talked about how it is grossly unfair and inhuman, really, to hold out the hope to people that in fact they could come to this country when you know when push comes to shove, we're not going to do that because the line will be drawn someday, surely because we can't take everybody in the world. But you know, I know I'm not answering your question directly, but only to acknowledge that it is certainly something I've grappled with, and I think that it's something that needs to be addressed more and more in terms of, you know, what are really the logical conclusions of the entire process if you haven't thought it through to the end. And again, identifying what your goals are.
Is there any element in our refugee program which would provide for the return of these people eventually after they become, or is it simply our program is aimed at integrating them?
Well, I think that the resettlement program is a pretty final step. When you've actually left the country, gone to the camps of asylum, and eventually come here, for most of those people, they are, in a sense, reborn. This is a making of a new life. Some of them, I think, would like to go back. So if we had better relations with the countries of Indochina, it might allow them to return. But those of them that have suffered severely would see this as a terrible breach in terms of recognizing the country that had done them irreparable harm in many cases. Last June, the second big Geneva conference that occurred, one of the major points in that conference was a plan, a comprehensive plan of action, it was called, and it was for the repatriation of refugees, not after they were resettled, but really as they initially came out of the countries of origin of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, they would be immediately screened and to determine if they were bona fide refugees or not. The ones that were screened out as not being refugees are to be repatriated, and even the ones that are screened as refugees, every effort is made to see, isn't there a way that they can be returned? Up to this point, however, for a variety of political reasons, but also economic reasons, the countries of Indochina have not been ready to receive these people back. There's a tremendous fear, for example, of the 51 that were forcibly repatriated from Hong Kong last December. We have no idea what actually occurred after they returned. There's no way to monitor that. Now, the Vietnamese say, oh, don't worry about it. We're not building jails. We want to build schools. Well, that's fine to say that in Hanoi, but what's actually going on at the village level, we don't really know. But I think what you're saying is perhaps related to this gentleman's question over here. There has to come a time, sometime in the near future, where we have to start looking at what this whole program has done in terms of drawing people out, and it has not addressed the issue of returning these people, not forcibly, but having them return to be productive members of those countries as those countries develop. Now, the case with the Cambodians is a little different. What I just said very much applies to the Vietnamese and, in many cases, the Laotians. But for the Cambodians on the border, they have been there for a purpose. For Thailand, for example, was never interested in having the Cambodian refugees resettled abroad, because that is a human buffer between Thailand and a government it opposes in Cambodia, the Vietnamese-supported government in Cambodia. Those people on the border would like very much to return to Cambodia, but they are totally caught and implicated in the resistance movement. So if there's a settlement in Cambodia, whatever that settlement is, will have to include plans, very elaborate plans, for the reintegration of those people in their own country.
Wilford, I saw recently it may have been the McNeil Lehrer report, a very detailed segment on what you've been talking about. One of the, I'll make the story as short as possible. They were the sign of an Italian hotel somewhere in Vietnam, which had absolutely nobody there. Beautiful.
The floating hotel?
Yes.
Yes.
And I got the impression, I got the same impression that you had, that they were all very friendly. But this trade embargo, that I also got the impression that what they wanted more than anything else was the investment in India so that they could pay for some of this stuff. In other words, they wanted American capital.
Yes.
Because I noticed in some of the market scenes they had some American goods there which have infiltrated around that route. Is that the main thing they want?
Yeah, they want the hard currency, very definitely. In fact, if you travel to that country, it was the most bizarre trip I've ever taken, in the sense I felt like I was a walking Brinks truck, because you have to take cold, hard cash with you, and you pay everything in American dollars. The Vietnamese are scrambling. I think that there is a recognition that they have really blown it in terms of the economic development of that country. It is absolutely the poorest of the poor. But the way they're going about it, it is rather intriguing. Again, you're mentioning that it hasn't been...
Then you're going to help us again when you leave them. But where have you come down on that
side? Well, I come down on the side, I think... I personally feel that they are a tremendous asset to this country, and I say that knowing full well that there is a chorus out there, if you will, that would see these people as a burden. But I really do feel that they've added a tremendous amount in terms of our cultural pluralism and et cetera. I think that they certainly are more of an asset than not. One of the things, though, about this, I think, that compared to, say, the refugees that came out of Europe at the end of the Second World War, or even the Hungarian refugees, which one chapter is about the Hungarian refugees, We're dealing with refugees from the third world, from the developing world. And that makes a big difference in the minds of many people, because although the first waves of refugees coming out of Indochina were highly skilled, rather cosmopolitan, college educated in many respects, the subsequent waves have not been of that level. And so some people when you mention that, well, we see them as an asset, we'll raise the question, well, how come there's so many on welfare rolls? And how is it that the state of California and Texas and whatever, large percentages, this is particularly true, say, of the Hmong refugees coming out of Laos. Fiercely independent people, polygamous, opium growing, slash and burn agriculture, plopped down in the middle of California, or in some cases Philadelphia and Providence, Rhode Island. And people question, how is it that they contribute economically? My personal feeling is that we have to remember that they didn't flee their countries to become economic assets in this country. They fled persecution. And so we deal with it, secondarily we deal with the economic impact. But my experience has been that anyone, and this again is really personal, I don't have any evidence to back this up, that will decide to leave a country, leave family members behind, get into many cases a leaking sailing craft, and make that attempt for freedom, I think they have a lot to offer, whether they can read or not. They're going to get those skills. And I think what we're finding is that initially they are on welfare, but what we find, as we're doing more longitudinal studies, we find that they do in fact integrate and they are picking themselves up. There's a tremendous thing that's been happening with the second generation. And this is what you see, I think, here at the University of Virginia, where you even have children of illiterate parents that are going on to college. They've been compared in many cases to the Jewish immigrants from Europe early in the century. The whole notion of family delayed gratification, whatever, get those kids into college. So. It might help certain aspects of it. One of the things that socialism did, it made everybody poor equally. Already, even with the small amount of investment that's occurred, particularly in the South, you already have these very noticeable discrepancies in terms of living standards. Some people are getting wealthy, and those that were poor are now poorer than they were before. But I would think that, practically speaking, some of the our welcome in Vietnam was related very much to people's memories of how they did prosper when we were there years ago. Yeah, I think so. The organization with oversight for both the protection and care of refugees is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. That has been the lead organization and really an umbrella organization, and the UNHCR, as it's known, then contracts with other agencies, voluntary organizations, et cetera, to meet the needs of the refugees. This is something there's a chapter in the book on the UNHCR, but in the interest of time, I didn't mention it today. They are under tremendous constraints right now as we speak with regard to their finances. They have been criticized over the years. I would have to say that perhaps some of the criticism is unfair, and it's very much in league with the criticisms that many people have of UN-type organizations anyway. But what we need to remember is that they are creatures of nations, governments. And the funding problem at UNHCR right now has meant a cutback of 20% in their aid to refugees around the world. And it isn't so much that countries like the United States are giving less, It's just that there are more refugees. And specifically related to the refugees in Indochina, while this is terrible in the sense that the camps in Hong Kong are absolutely atrocious in terms of services, et cetera, but we have to remember that we have close to 6 million refugees from Afghanistan that are now in Iran and also in Pakistan. And you have a large numbers of refugees throughout Africa. I mean, the largest contingent of refugees are in Africa. And so they're, because of the financial problems, they are not able to meet the needs. One of the interesting things about that is that we assume, I know I did when I started this, and somebody said, oh, the UN is in charge of protecting and taking care of these refugees. They certainly must be doing a fine job. We don't have to worry. And that I found to be an erroneous assumption. And again, related to national interest, because even if the UNHCR has the money and the goods to help these refugees, they are only in a country, say, like Thailand, at the invitation of the Thai government. So even if they're there to prevent, protect what we would declare as universal human rights, they are not permitted to just walk in and just take over. That was brought home to me when, in 84, I found myself in a refugee camp, a very small camp up near the Mekong River near the Laotian border inside Thailand. And I went with some Quakers that were running the camp, and it was one of those things, if you've been to Bangkok, you know that if you have to go through all the bureaucracy, you might as well forget it because you'll be at the airport and going home by the time it gets worked out. So I thought, hey, I'll just go. It was far enough away. And so we went into the camp, and I did my interviewing and all that I wanted to do and whatever. And sure enough, about mid-afternoon, I got a tap on the shoulder and said, who are you and what are you doing here? And where's your paper? And I said, well, I don't have a paper. I'm very sorry and whatever. And I had to leave. But the fact was I had been in there. Well, when I left the camp, I went into the reception area, and there was the UNHCR protection officer who had been there all day and had never gotten in because he didn't have Thai permission. So, and I was in there recording the abuses in many ways. And he, the protection officer, wasn't allowed in. So again, the conflict. Yeah.
We've gone on longer than we normally do. I want to just tell a quick little story about the book. And I haven't mentioned this either to Valerie or Bob. There's a kind of terrible parochialism, I think, in the university and in society at large. There's parochialism about some of you, insofar as the university faculty are concerned. They have no idea how smart some of you are. Maybe you sometimes aren't totally even-handed with some of them, they think. There's generational dispute. We have generational differences in my department, and they cause lines. When Valerie came into the government department courses, why, she had almost the equivalent of a scarlet letter. She was in the field of education. And remember the biblical phrase, can any good come out of education? So I was a little nervous until about the first or second seminar, and then I noticed, even before I'd read any of her papers, that she was perfectly prepared to take on anybody and everybody. Maybe she has practice at home, she more than proved herself with the seminar dialogue, and it was so different from what I've been troubled about. One day in a seminar, somebody said, why is it whenever a woman makes a comment, she prefaces the comment by saying, of course, I don't know as much about this as you do. And there was a pause, and then a woman raised her hand, and she said, of course, I don't know as much about this subject as you do, and went on to make a thoroughly sensible and wise comment on the thing. Anyway, the papers were even better than the discussion. The manuscript was even better than the papers. And the book is here for anybody who has any interest. And I think this is just the beginning, because contrast maybe to some of the rest of us, why Valerie has a few years to continue to press all these issues the way she so characteristically has done today. And we're thrilled and delighted that she's been with us for this discussion.
Thank you. Any